Welcome to Onc Live On Air. I'm your host today, Ashling Wehner. In today's episode, we had the pleasure of speaking with Jonathan M. Gerber, MD, and Shyam A. Patel, MD, PhD, about a study they conducted investigating the use of immunohistochemistry as a biomarker for early TP53 mutation identification in patients with myelodysplastic syndromes and acute myeloid leukemia. In our exclusive interview, Drs. Gerber and Patel discussed the evaluation of P53-IHC as a surrogate biomarker for TP53 mutant, MDS, and AML. They shared how the presence of TP53 mutations in these diseases significantly worsens prognosis, necessitating urgent treatment. They also highlighted how IHC results are available within 48 to 72 hours. Gerber and Patel explained this study's design and patient population, as well as how IHC's inverse correlation with overall survival highlights its potential as an early biomarker, though it has lower sensitivity for certain mutations.
To start us off with some background and rationale, how does the prolonged turnaround time for NGS impact clinical decision-making in TP53 mutant MDS and AML, and how does this naturally beget the rationale for evaluating P53-IHC as a potential surrogate?
TP53 mutations are arguably our most desperate unmet need in MDS and AML. These patients have a far worse prognosis overall. And while this is true across many diseases, it's particularly true in sort of the MDS and AML realm. The issues that we get into, and particularly true for AML, where it often can be an explosive disease that requires very urgent treatment or even emergent treatment in some cases, the turnaround time for next generation sequencing or NGS is often on the order of 2 weeks, and it actually can be longer than that, even at many academic medical centers. Even more true, I would argue, for smaller centers and those that that lack in-house capabilities. The other piece of the equation is that TP53 can't be tested outside of NGS for at least sequencing of the genes. There isn't an available PCR test. All of the commercially available assays are ones that that involve next-gen sequencing. So you're sort of limited at that turnaround time if you actually want to use the gold standard for identification of a mutant in TP53. And hence the rationale for doing this, and this was really an idea that that Dr. Patel was trying to drive forward, is there any way that we can speed this process up? The use of immunohistochemistry or IHC for identification of mutant P53 protein is a much faster test. So we can perform that on bone marrow biopsies. Basically, you can get an answer typically within 48 hours and usually almost never less or never more than rather 72 hours. So the specimen, once it's out, needs to go through a decalcification and preparation or fixation process. But the staining is usually within 24 hours of that. And so it's relatively fast. The pathologists are able to read these relatively quickly. And so as close to real time as we can get for an answer on a mutant P53. And we'll talk a little bit more. It's not a perfect assay, but it is very highly specific. And so if it's there, we can be pretty confident that there's a mutation in TP53. If the staining isn't positive, there are some additional wrinkles, but basically enables us to make a decision far faster, shaving off, up to 2 weeks or more from decision making. And often we need to make a decision in those patients before we have all the data. Patients with TP53 mutations typically are resistant, or their leukemia or MDS is typically resistant to standard intensive chemotherapy. So those are regimens that often have all the traditional side effects of what people associate with old school chemotherapy. They often will land a patient in the hospital for on the order of a month or more. And so a lot of toxicity with little to no benefit. So it'd be great to be able to identify those patients before we subject them to intensive chemotherapy regimens that arguably aren't going to be beneficial for them.
Could you just briefly walk us through what's important to know about the trial design, including, any important baseline characteristics of patients enrolled, as well as important methodology employed?
Sure. So in this study, we identified 137 unique patients with MDS or AML with TP53 mutation based on the ICC or International Consensus Classification of Myeloid Neoplasms. And among these 137 unique patients, 82 of those patients had concurrently available data for both immunohistochemistry as well as next-generation sequencing testing. The patients spanned a variety of racial demographics and ethnicities, so we tried to ensure equal representation. Of note, the majority of the patients in the study were of non-Hispanic white ethnicity, as well as male sex, just simply based off of the demographics or epidemiology of myeloid neoplasms with TP53. In total, we had about 145 bone marrow specimens that were found that had concurrently available data for IHC as well as for NGS testing. And 61% of these cases were MDS. About 39% of the cases were AML. We consider the immunohistochemical test to be the index test or the test in question, whereas the NGS test was the gold standard referent test. And as for methodology, we collaborated with our Department of Pathology to perform this P53 immunohistochemical staining on bone marrow specimens for patients who had a confirmed diagnosis of either MDS with mutated TP53 or AML with mutated TP53 per the ICC definition. The IHC scoring rate ranged from less than 1%, meaning negative, to 90%, to about 90%, meaning strongly positive. And in some cases, the scoring was qualitative, namely 1+, 2+, or 3+, suggesting weak, moderate, or strong staining. And so those slides were reassessed by our team to perform a more to yield a more quantitative output, namely the actual percentage P53 positivity. We noticed that the predominant pattern for immunohistochemical staining was nuclear, which is consistent with the accumulation of the mutant P53 protein. We concurrently set up a set of negative controls, which included patients without hematologic neoplasms, or these are just patients who ended up having a normal bone marrow biopsy, patients who had MDS but with wild-type TP53, and then patients with AML but with wild-type P53. We also accounted for bone marrow cellularity by assessing the correlation between the IHC positivity and cellularity, as well as the accounting for age by assessing the correlation between age at diagnosis with P53 IHC positivity. And from there, we performed the correlative analysis for P53 IHC with NGS testing.
What were the main findings reported in this analysis?
Most important factors that determines the risk for these types of conditions is that TP53 allelic state can determine the prognosis for patients. So the best inference for allelic state that we have currently is based off the 2022 ICC definition, which clearly defines multi-hit from the clinical context. But the designation of multi-hit is not exactly fitting with biallelic TP53 disruption, but that's probably the best estimate that we have. So in our study, we aim to identify the singular threshold of P53 IHC positivity that would best correlate with multi-hit status, and then from there, possibly biallelic TP53 disruption. So in our study, we performed a statistical method known as bootstrapping, and we found that the IHC threshold of about 7% best correlated with multi-hit TP53 status. And it's important to know this information because the early identification of multi-hit TP53 might change the overall plan or the goals of care for a given patient. For example, if you can identify that a patient has TP53 multi-hit status early on, those patients might benefit from an expedited stem cell transplant, or they might benefit from just knowing this prognostic information early on. So that was the overall main finding for the article.
You know, it's interesting, right? Because when we get the next generation sequencing, we're getting a percentage of the alleles that are mutant or more normal. So, you know, every normal cell at least should have two copies of TP53, and either or both can be mutant. They can have the same mutation, meaning homozygous, or they could be different mutations, which would be a compound heterozygote. Both are what we would consider biallelic. And then as an additional readout, whether they carry other genetic abnormalities in them, and particularly either multiple TP53 mutations or whether they've They've got an abnormal cytogenetic profile, meaning abnormalities, more structural on the chromosomes. And so we know that those patients do particularly poorly. In fact, when we've looked at our own series of patients and, you know, from a vast experience and again, agrees with the published literature, patients that have an allele burden, I think there's almost unanimous consensus on the fact that if it exceeds 40%, there are almost no survivors, even with our nuclear option of allogeneic stem cell transplant. When it gets into the as low as probably 20%, it still looks like that may be a relatively hard cutoff for very few, if any, survivors, again, even with allogeneic transplant. And so we attempted to correlate those with actual the protein staining, the P53 IHC, actually gives you a cell percentage. So how many mutant cells are there on the bone marrow biopsy, not just sort of what were the genes or the like. And so slightly different measure, if you will. They're obviously correlated with one another, but that 7% cutoff, a remarkably low one when you think about it. And you know, it sort of shows you that you know, we don't have a lot of time to act on these patients. As I mentioned earlier, intensive chemotherapy, largely ineffective, certainly in the higher allele burdens from data that we know, which sort of leaves you with using hypomethylating agent-based therapies. Those are traditionally ones that we think of more for elderly or unfit patients. But interestingly, even though they're considered gentler therapies, they're no less effective and arguably more effective in these patients. And using them, they're not curative, but using them as a bridge to allo transplant. And as Dr. Patel mentioned, trying to get that done earlier, you know, the sooner the better, arguably, seems to be our best strategy at present. And hence knowing the TP53 status, you know, as soon as we can, so that we divert patients into the correct therapies and start transplant planning, et cetera. Even a couple of weeks is a useful lead time, sometimes a very, very critical and useful lead time. The other piece that I think is worth mentioning, you know, when we say 7%, right, we're still probably talking about hundreds of millions to billions of cells, maybe even hundreds of billions in some patients. So it's 7% of a big number still.
I wanted to ask if there was anything else that you want to expand on regarding the conclusions drawn from the association between the false negative IHC with the nonsense and frame chip mutations and or the inverse correlation between the P53 positivity and overall survival, and just how that, you know, maybe adds to these conclusions that are being drawn.
Yes, that's a really great question. So we did perform a detailed codon analysis for IHC versus NGS correlation. And we noted that the negative IHC results were sometimes seen in patients who had either nonsense, frame shift, or DEL17P, or isochromosome 17. So it suggests that the IHC results had a relatively low sensitivity, but a higher specificity. So it suggests that this test could be a good rule-in test, but not necessarily a rule-out test, because in some cases, we might miss patients who actually have a nonsense frame shift or DEL17P. So a clinician might not want to conclude that a patient has wild-type P53 based on a negative test if they ended up having a nonsense mutation or DEL17P or frame shift, because there is a chance of a false negative result. So in those cases, the clinician may want to wait for the full NGS results to come back. However, in the case of at least one missense mutation, we almost always found that the IHC was positive. Whereas if there was no missense mutation and purely just sole nonsense isochromosome 17 or DEL17P, there were a good number of cases that were false negatives or missed. So we have to interpret this in the right clinical context. And in terms of the question about the relationship between the IHC and the overall survival, we did find that the IHC correlated with an inverse overall survival. The data suggests that a higher IHC positivity is linked with worse outcomes. And specifically, we performed subgroup analysis based on the IHC quintile and noticed that inverse correlation with median overall survival. The implications from a clinical standpoint are that This information can provide early information about survival statistics, and IHC could be a useful early biomarker to guide discussions about prognostication. As an example, let's say if a patient was found to have an IHC percentage of 80% positive, their median overall survival based on our study was about 2.5 months. Whereas on the other hand, if a patient was found to have an IHC positivity of only about 20%, their median overall survival was as long as 8 months. So the field might benefit from larger scale studies or multi-institutional analyses for biomarker validation of P53 immunohistochemistry for patients who have TP53 mutant MDS or AML.
As you can tell, those are pretty humbling survival numbers, right? That really the only numbers that start to look more favorable are as we get into the single digit percents on the IHC. So really, really striking. I think, you know, an equivalent to looking at, you know, again, those cases less than 20% on the VAF, the variant allele frequency on the next gen sequencing. The other kinds of interesting things, we don't know that all mutations are created equal in TP53. Certainly if there's any preserved wild type function, there's a sense that those patients, you know, may do better. We're starting to look at some of those outlier cases just to get a better sense of you know, how we might be able to better parse patients or, you know, distinguish outcomes, et cetera. The interesting thing is that because our data set was still relatively limited, it's one of the largest ones in this series, you know, for TP53 patients, but it's, you know, still less than 150 patients. And so, you know, as we start to look at some of these subtleties, as we compare data across centers and you know, try to get into some of the nuances of individual mutations, we might have a better sense. We tried to look at whether there was any disparity between the IHC and the VAF and, you know, if those were meaningful differences. And honestly, our numbers probably weren't large enough to tease that out. But we do know from some other data that isolated deletions of TP53 with one preserved wild type copy certainly don't have the same adverse clinical impact that mutations do as a whole, you know, like missense mutations, or if obviously you've knocked out both copies.
It seems like there's a lot of clear kind of next steps to take this analysis. So obviously you've already alluded to some of these, but is there anything else that you feel really needs to be learned or any other next steps that are planned for validating this as an early biomarker?
Being able to make these decisions in particularly in the AML patients where there is a lot of urgency for treatment. You know, we tend to see these TP53 mutations more often in lower white count AML and MDS, where you do have a little bit more time often to make a decision. But certainly we do see them still in more aggressive presentations with a high white blood cell count and really, you know, urgent to emergent need for treatment. And so the earlier we can get those data, the better we can customize or personalize therapy for a given patient. And, you know, again, doing a transplant, doing these other things takes some timing. So even when we have some temporary control over the disease, say with a hypomethylating agent-based therapy, our window for transplant is narrow. There does seem to be benefit to transplant across the board, even in the worst cases where we probably, you know, rarely if ever will cure a patient, we still often do prolong their lives. But, you know, being able to capture them early seems to be our best sort of strategy, if you will. The only cures that we, you know, we've had in our series and our long-term remissions that we've had have been at both low variant allele frequency and low IHC. And so, you know, looking at this as an additional rapid marker, allowing us to appropriately risk stratify patients and delegate therapies appropriately. Certainly there are more nuances, as I alluded to, that, you know, we're going to need to work out over time as a field. You know, we certainly want to validate these data and a larger cohort of patients as well.
I completely agree with Dr. Gerber. And in addition to that, we may also want to consider the technical aspects of the PBC3 immunohistochemistry in terms of the large-scale validation of the IHC as an early surrogate for TP53 mutation. For example, some of the next questions that we may want to think about as a field would be, are there any antibody subtypes or methodologies that can lead to increased sensitivity for the IHC for detecting the actual P53 mutation? The other aspect is the global cost savings. So as you know, in many low and middle income countries, there might not be ready access to NGS testing, and they may rely on more general basic histopathological techniques like immunohistochemistry for determining disease designation. So it's possible that IHC potentially could be valuable to lower middle income countries that don't have the ability or the funds for performing NGS testing, and especially for, you know, discerning allelic state like VAF and things like that. So it might be worth, you know, considering commercializing this if there was validation of this test in from a multi-institutional perspective.
Even within the U.S., right, in some of our more underserved areas, more rural communities, et cetera, where there might not be ready access both to the sort of the expertise and to the availability of NGS testing, that this is a relatively simple, straightforward assay. You know, most pathology labs, if they have the reagents, which are relatively inexpensive, should be capable of performing this. And then, you know, hopefully expediting early referral, facilitating early referral to transplant capable centers, et cetera. The other piece of this is that, you know, I think this is a test that, you know, we're fortunate that we had really expert hematopathologists reviewing these slides and, you know, familiar with the assays, et cetera. I think there are certainly some opportunities as technology is improving, artificial intelligence, et cetera, to automate the process and the read and even speed that up and standardize it as well. And again, I think a complementary piece of information in some ways, you get some insight into the function of the protein that we don't always get from NGS. We sort of imply functional consequences from that. But if the protein abnormally localizes, if the staining is more intense, gives you a little bit of insight that, hey, this is a mutation that is actually disrupting the wild type function. So I think as we learn more, as we look at more cases, we'll probably have a better sense of that. The other piece that we haven't talked much about is just therapeutic implications in terms of the future, right? And so, you know, again, as mentioned earlier, this is arguably our most desperate unmet need in leukemia and related diseases. And so, and this is true even for solid tumors, et cetera. So just across a variety of cancers, but especially in MDS and AML. And so, you know, the ability to get an answer earlier and actually be able to contemplate clinical trials, screen patients as early as possible, and even look at upfront clinical trial options for them is critical as well. We haven't really had a lot of success yet in coming up with therapies that are effective against mutant TP53, especially those higher allele burdens, but at least gives us some hope that we might be able to delegate patients into trials as early as possible as well, and give them the best chance that we might have for survival, and, you know, use these as correlates to better understand who may benefit from a trial.
I completely agree with Dr. Gerber, and these are all very excellent points. From the clinical, I guess, from the translational perspective, as you know, we've seen a lot of negative trials in the literature for targeted therapeutics for TP53, or at least therapeutics that might work against that particular subset. Namely, for example, we've seen overall, you know, negative results for the ENHANCE 2 or ENHANCE 3 trials, both in press in the journal Blood currently, as well as a few other targeted therapeutics like eprenetipop, sabatolimab, which has been suspected to be involved in P53 mutant MDS AML. So at the current time, there still remains a major pressing need. So I think the more insight we can gain into disease biology for this particular subset, the more likely we can validate targets that may be amenable to targeting. So I think that with more like multi-institutional or collaborative efforts across various investigators, hopefully we can try to move the field forward and, you know, lead to positive progress in the field. one consideration within the field of stem cell transplant might be the consideration about expedited stem cell transplant for patients who have multi-hit mutations. So as Dr. Gerber mentioned, the stem cell transplant is thought to be the main curative intent option for these patients. So I think early identification of patients who have multi-hit TP53 or biallelic TP53 status would benefit from that more expedited evaluation. There have been a variety of studies through the CIBMTR or the BMT-CTN that have looked at kind of larger scale cohorts for transplant outcomes for P53 mutant MDS or AML. So the key might be to just, you know, as quickly as possible, have these patients proceed with stem cell transplant if they are eligible for it. So hopefully, you know, if this biomarker can be validated in larger scale studies and across different institutions, perhaps that would lead to a path towards more expedited stem cell transplant evaluation.
Inevitably, at some point, we're going to see technology get to the point where next generation sequencing is faster, earlier, more widespread use, including in, you know, outside of hematology and oncology, right? So we're already starting to see that in other fields. As we understand clonal hematopoiesis better and we start to sort of get a sense of the evolution of these diseases, you know, it's conceivable in the same way we do a CBC on a patient and, you know, it's a routine lab test, that we may have really early data on these mutations and how they're arising. You know, in prior work that we've done, and Dr. Patel can comment more on this, we found that patients with clonal hematopoiesis, you know, so not meeting yet, not having advanced yet into myelodysplastic syndrome or acute myeloid leukemia, but with sort of these preceding conditions, that those that had TP53 mutations, other than maybe a rare patient who was a transient, you know, are finding maybe an artifact or maybe just a small clone that wasn't at a stem cell level and burned itself out, that anybody with a sustained TP53 mutation never behaved. They all advanced to either MDS or AML. And so, you know, potentially catching these patients as early as we can. And, you know, I'm not suggesting we do bone marrow biopsies and IHC on all of them. I think right now IHC is a great bridge. And as Dr. Patel mentioned, I think an underserved area is a really, really potentially useful option. But I can envision a time where we're getting routine NGS on people across the board and much deeper sequencing, and including in healthy individuals, and catching these things early until such time as we have a better therapy that's effective in those cases might be a really good option. That, as crazy as it sounds, you know, considering a transplant in someone who's otherwise healthy, it might be a real discussion in the time to come.
That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening to this episode of OncLive On Air. Check back throughout the week for exclusive interviews with leading experts in the oncology field. For more updates in oncology, be sure to visit onclive.com and sign up for our e-newsletters. OncLive is also on social media. On X and Blue Sky, follow us at OncLive. On Facebook, like us at OncLive, and follow our OncLive page on LinkedIn. If you liked today's episode of OncLive On Air, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and many of your other favorite podcast platforms so you get a notification every time a new episode is posted. While you're there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening to OncLive On Air.